Okay, let's unpack this. We've got a stack of source material today that feels like it was pulled from half a dozen different university departments.
Yeah, it really does.
We're talking about psychology, the nuts and bolts of how computers work, geography, navigation, and even how knowledge itself gets organized.
It's quite the intellectual journey,
Yeah.
from the fleeting thoughts in our heads to like logic gates on a chip.
To the whole planet, yeah, and how we structure information about it all.
Exactly.
So our mission, as always with the deep dive, is to be your guide through this, well, fascinating mix. We're going to try and quickly pull out the most important insights, maybe some surprising facts.
Show you some of the principles and histories across these fields.
Right. Think of it as exploring how different parts of the world and, well, our minds are measured, structured, and organized.
We'll help you see the core ideas, maybe some connections hiding in there, what stands out, and, why it might matter.
Perfect. So let's dive in and see what fascinating nuggets we can find for you. We'll start with how our own internal world is structured, beginning with psychology.
Okay.
The material mentions linguistics at first, but the real focus here seems to be on memory and the unconscious.
Memory is a great place to start. The sources really highlight how much is going on sort of beneath our conscious awareness. Take sensory memory.
Right, that first super brief recording your senses make.
Exactly. Iconic for visual, echoic for auditory. It's
Yeah.
like it's there and then poof, gone almost immediately.
And there's that classic experiment, George Sperling, 1960, showed how much is actually captured
Yeah, he flashed, what was it, 12 letters?
for just 1/20th of a second. Like, blink and you'd miss it.
And when people tried to list all 12, they could only get maybe 4 or 5.
Too simple enough.
But the twist was, they felt like they'd seen more. They had this sense the whole picture was there, just inaccessible.
So Sperling got clever. He used tones right after the flash.
High tone for the top row, medium for middle, low for bottom. Report just that row.
And that was the breakthrough.
Totally. Because they could recall letters from any cued row most of the time. It proved the entire grid of letters was available briefly in that sensory snapshot.
Wow. So it's all there for a moment.
Right, a rich picture, but our brain just grabs a few bits before the rest fades. It's like the first filter structuring what we even perceive.
Okay, so moving deeper now into the structure of the mind, the sources shift pretty dramatically to the unconscious.
Yeah, not just fleeting input, but this hypothetical deep region.
Described as what, holding hidden wishes, memories, fears?
Exactly. Stuff kept from conscious awareness, but still influencing thoughts, dreams, even neuriac symptoms, according to the source.
And this isn't the same as the preconscious, right? Those thoughts you can recall easily.
No, this is stuff actively kept down,
Yeah.
harder to access.
Where did this idea come from, mainly?
Well, the sources point squarely at Sigmund Freud, around 1895 to 1900,
And his view was.
that it held things like leftover infantile feelings, instinctual drives, especially what he called libido, all shaped by the superego.
But Carl Jung had a different take, also mentioned here.
Right, in his analytical psychology.
Yeah.
For Jung, libido wasn't just sexual energy, it was like all creative instincts, the whole life force.
Okay. And he structured the unconscious differently, too.
Yeah, he saw two layers. The personal unconscious, that's your own unique experiences, memories, etc.
And the other layer.
The collective unconscious. This is the really big idea.
Selective, like shared.
Exactly. A universal reservoir of the whole human race's experience, supposedly. And within that, he proposed archetypes.
Archetypes. Primordial images, is that right? Bits of intuitive knowledge.
That's the idea. Common patterns across cultures and times. Think of mythological figures, spirits, good versus evil.
The sources mention mother and father figures as key examples.
Yes, very prominent ones. And these archetypes tend to emerge more when the conscious mind is less active, like in dreams, or when you're caught off guard. Suggests a kind of deep shared structure to our inner lives.
So, how have people tried to, I guess, measure or get at these hidden structures? The sources list a few methods.
Well, there's the Rorschach inkblot test from 1921, interpreting ambiguous shapes to reveal personality or unconscious stuff.
Though its scientific status is often debated, right?
Very much so. Then you have historical things like phrenology.
Ah, feeling bumps on the skull. Late 18th, early 19th century.
That's the one. Popular, but totally unscientific. Still, the basic idea.
That mental functions relate to brain areas.
Yeah, that underlying idea turned out to be right, just not the bump part.
And a modern contrast mentioned is EEG, electroencephalography.
Right. recording the brain's electrical activity directly from the scalp, an objective measure of function, not skull shape.
And the sources also nod to, like, large-scale data, charts on mental disorder prevalence from surveys.
Yeah, showing another way psychology tries to quantify and structure things, looking at population patterns. Very different from ink blots.
Okay, so from the kind of hazy, deep structures of the mind, the sources just pivot completely. Bam! Computers.
Yeah, quite the gear shift. Right into the precise, engineered structures.
The basics. CPU, input like a keyboard, storage, output like a monitor, standard stuff.
And the CPU itself broken down. Arithmetic logic unit for the math and comparisons.
Registers holding data.
Control section directing everything, and the internal bus connecting it all.
But the real core concept, the sources say, is digital logic.
Absolutely. It all boils down to making true-false decisions based on Boolean algebra. True is one, false is zero, physically represented by voltages in the circuits.
And these logic circuits use those true-false inputs to make decisions, built from basic logic gates.
Yep, things like OR, AND, NOT, NOR, gates, each doing a simple logical operation.
Boolean algebra gives the rules for juggling these ones and E's. And truth tables.
Truth tables, just map it out. Show you what output you get for every possible input combination to a gate. The source mentions the NOR gate. Output is zero. False if any input is one. True.
Simple rules, but powerful.
That's the foundation. This ability to make decisions with ones and zeros, the sources even list the five steps a computer takes for an instruction fetch, decode, get data, operate, save result. It's all the control unit managing this flow of digital signals.
And what happens when you scale this up? The sources mention Deep Blue.
Ah, yeah, IBM's supercomputer from 97. Famous for chess.
It used massively parallel process, like tons of processors working together.
256 of them. And the source highlights its power crunching 50 to 100 billion chess moves in under 3 minutes.
Which is amazing, but it's not just for games.
No way. That kind of scaled up logic power is what enables, you know, complex weather forecasting, drug discovery, genetics research, simulating things like toxic waste cleanup.
Even powering the web servers we all use.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The simple structure of ones and errors, organized logically, scales up to this immense capability that basically structures our modern world.
Okay, let's shift gears again, leaving the micro level of chips for the macro level of, well, the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Geography, navigation, and then organizing knowledge.
Right. Starting with Earth's patterns.
Yeah.
Weather maps, first up, built from radar, satellite images, mapping out snow, rain, temperature gradients.
And they detail prevailing winds, the doldrums near the equator, the trade winds, named for the direction they blow from.
Uh-huh. Then the prevailing westerlies, polar easterlies, global patterns.
And world precipitation patterns are linked too. High near the equator, low at the poles, and around 30 degrees latitude.
Yeah, and the sources connect these beautifully with the tropical weather cell and the ITCZ, the intertropical convergence zone.
Okay, break that down.
Think of it like a giant engine. Sunlight hits the equator, warms the air, makes it rise. That's low pressure, lots of rain clouds, cumulonimbus.
Right.
That rising air moves towards the poles, cools down, and then sinks around 30 degrees latitude. Sinking air means high pressure, dry conditions. That's where many deserts are.
Ah, okay.
And that sinking air gets pulled back towards the equator along the surface, creating the trade winds. Where they meet and rise again, that's the ITCZ. It's this huge, structured cycle of air and moisture.
The sources also mention atmospheric layers and how temperature changes.
Yeah, troposphere and mesosphere get colder as you go up.
Mm-hmm.
But the stratosphere and thermosphere get warmer. That's temperature inversion.
And that inversion matters.
Big time. It stops air mixing much between layers. So the troposphere, where we live, gets all mixed up by weather, but the stratosphere above it is much more stable, layered.
And then a bit of atmospheric optics, the rainbow.
Huh, yeah. Nicely explained as raindrops just bending, refracting, and reflecting sunlight, splitting into colors. Red bends least, violet most.
Primary bows red outside, secondary ones reversed. A neat structured result of light and water.
Then shifting from air to water, ocean currents. Driven mostly by those prevailing winds we mentioned.
Like the cold west wind drift or the warm Gulf Stream.
Exactly. And these currents flow in huge circular paths, gyres.
Clockwise in the northern hemisphere, counterclockwise in the southern.
That's the pattern. The sources even point out the Antarctic gyre, flowing clockwise around the South Pole, driven by the counterclockwise flows of the oceans around it, another massive planetary structure.
So how do we structure our understanding of location on this planet? Geographic grids, latitude and longitude.
The absolute basics. Latitude lines run horizontal, parallel, starting at 0 degrees of the equator. Longitude lines run vertical, pole to pole, starting at 0 degrees at the prime meridian in Greenwich.
And using those two angular measures, you can pinpoint any spot on Earth. It's the fundamental grid.
The sources even show data on hours of daylight by latitude. It makes it really clear how day length changes dramatically depending on how far north or south you are.
Especially near the poles, right? 24 hours of daylight or darkness in summer, winter.
Directly tied to Earth's tilt and your latitude coordinate on that grid.
This leads into geodesy, the science of measuring the Earth precisely.
Yep. Measuring its shape, points on its surface. Historically, this meant setting up control points markers on the ground with known coordinates.
Measuring their lat, long, height, building a network.
Right. And it was tough work. Measuring angles with telescopes, building towers to see over trees, camping out for months.
And the errors added up, like over 3 meters across the U.S.
Yeah, with those old methods. Compare that to today.
Which brings us to GPS, the Global Positioning System, a total game changer for structuring location.
A network of, what, 24 satellites constantly orbiting?
And your phone or GPS device figures out where it is by timing signals from several of them?
Exactly. It's basically triangulating its position based on how long those signals take to arrive. It needs signals from at least 3 or 4 satellites.
And the accuracy leap is just staggering. The sources say down to centimeters for coordinates.
And measuring continents in hours with maybe 1 centimeter accuracy, it's completely changed how we measure and interact with physical space. Think logistics, farming, everything.
Geodesy also deals with map projections, making sure they're accurate, setting data standards.
Speaking of maps, another way we structure geographic info visually, the sources cover map legends.
The key defining the symbols.
Right. And symbols themselves packing info onto the map.
Mm-hmm.
And maps scale the ratio between map distance and real distance.
Like 1 to 1 million.
Exactly. Then map projections how you get the round Earth onto flat paper. Each distorts things differently.
Azimuthal for poles, cylindrical near the equator, conic for mid-latitudes.
And the Robinson projection mentioned, designed to minimize distortion overall, showing poles as lines, not points.
But in specific map types, relief maps.
Those 3D terrain models. Yeah. Good for engineering, military planning.
And topographic maps, or topo maps.
Yeah. Super detailed. They show general location, boundaries, plus geology, special features, essential for hikers, planners.
Using contour lines, those brown squiggles to show elevation, closer lines mean steeper terrain.
Exactly. And colors for vegetation, symbols for buildings, railroads, etc. And the source even mentions using radar mapping for Venus topography.
Wow, applying the same structuring principles beyond Earth.
Totally. Shows how fundamental these ways of representing space are.
Okay, so we have maps and positioning systems. How do we use them? Navigation. The sources go way back.
Yeah, early seafarers, 3500 BC maybe, sticking close to shore, using landmarks, giving them colorful names like Lone Rock.
Then coastal piloting, navigating by sight of land, using compass bearings to landmarks.
Right. You take a bearing, draw a line on your chart from the landmark. You know, you're somewhere on that line of position.
And if that line crosses your estimated track based on speed and course your dead reckoning track, that's better. An estimated position.
More reliable than just dead reckoning alone, yeah.
But the best is a fix.
That's the gold standard. Take bearings on 2 or more different objects, plot those lines of position, where they cross. That's your spot.
Yeah.
Very accurate.
But manual navigation has limits. Human error, wind, currents, which leads to inertial navigation.
Ah, the high-tech solution. Uses electronic instruments to track position automatically. Sort of like dead reckoning, but done by sensors and computers.
Constantly measuring speed, direction, acceleration.
Right. Overcoming drift from wind or currents. Key parts are the gyroscope.
Sensing orientation changes.
Yeah, it resists being tilted off course. Can be set to true north, acts like a compass immune to magnetic interference, then the accelerometer measures motion.
And a computer puts it all together.
Calculates position, makes adjustments, it provides constant, accurate navigation data, can even act as an autopilot. Reliable even when you can't see anything outside. A huge structural shift in navigation.
Okay, wow. Mind, machine, planet, navigation.
Huh.
So finally, after all this, the sources look at how we structure knowledge itself. Library classification system.
Yeah, the systems we use to organize all these books and materials we've been talking about, basically. Helps you find stuff.
First up, Dewey Decimal. Melville Dewey, 1876. Structures all knowledge into 10 main classes, 1000 to 999.
That's the one. Covers everything. Generalities, philosophy, religion, social sciences, language, science, tech, arts, literature, history, geography.
And it's hierarchical. Main classes divide into 10 subclasses, then keep dividing with decimals for specifics.
Exactly. Like 800 is literature, 810 American lit, 813 American fiction, 813.4 for a specific period, 813.46 for a specific author like Henry James. Very structured.
Used worldwide, long history, gets updated.
Right. Then there's the Library of Congress system, LC, developed by their staff. Uses letters instead of just numbers.
21 main classes, A, B, C, D, skipping a few letters, arranged general to specific.
And uses combinations of letters and numbers for more specific topics. N for fine arts, NA architecture, ND painting, ND 813 Spanish painting, ND 813 G7 for Goya.
And it's seen as more flexible than Dewey, better for big research libraries.
Yeah, avoids super long numbers for very specific topics.
Yeah.
Continuously revised, too.
And the last one mentioned is UDC, Universal Decimal Classification.
Different initial goal. More about retrieving information from documents, not just finding books on shelves, though it can do that, too.
Its main feature is?
It's better at showing relationships between concepts. You can combine notation to represent complex ideas.
Which makes it good for computer databases.
Exactly. Because it can capture those multifaceted connections, also constantly updated. So, three different ways to impose structure on the vast world of knowledge.
Wow. What a trip through this material. We've seen how our minds structure perception and memory, the logic structuring computers, the physical systems and grids structuring Earth and our location on it, the tech for navigating that space.
And then the systems we invented just to organize all the information about everything else.
It really does highlight how in so many different areas, we rely on these systems, these structures to measure things, organize them, just make sense of the complexity.
Uh-huh. Internal, external, abstract.
So hopefully, for you listening, this deep dive gave you some new ways to think about the structures behind, well, why you forget something instantly, or how your phone knows where you are, or even just how library books get their spot on the shelf.
Yeah, and thinking about all these different structures, the psychological ones, the computer logic, the geographic grids, the library codes, it kind of brings up a bigger question, doesn't it?
Mm.
Like, how much does the way we choose to structure and measure the world fundamentally shape what we can actually know and understand about the world and maybe even about ourselves?
That is a perfect thought to end on. Definitely something to chew on. Keep exploring those structures, everyone, the hidden ones and the obvious ones.